Hello and welcome to the Vulgar Victory Podcast. Today we have two special guests and I will let them introduce themselves right now.
Hi Glenn, thanks for having us. I'm Sarah Morum, and Tracy Ornberg-Lemon and I have known each other since college. So since I was 18, I've known Tracy. So this is fantastic that she and I are here together to talk about our journey with our anti-racism work. And also I'm just so humbled to be here. You know, I think as a white woman, I just realized how protected I've been from a lot of history and violence that white women have put upon black men and the black community. And I own that as part of my own history and how it's such a problem, how protected I've been as a white woman, just protected from so much pain that my actions and the actions of my white culture have caused the black community. So much violence, loss of life. So I'm just really here today to talk about what I've learned, what I'm still learning. It's a lifelong journey, anti-racism work, owning my own ignorance, owning my own fragility, how that's been very problematic with, you know, my own behavior, pain that I've caused. So I'm here to own, atone, and repair. So I also want to say until recently, I wasn't even familiar with the meme Karen. And again, that just reinforces again how protected I am as a white woman, or I don't even have to know about a meme that is about my behavior. So humbling. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you for joining. And Tracy?
Hi, I am Tracy Wernberg-Lem, and I, Sarah and I go way back, so I am also very humbled and feel very honored to be on your podcast. I have a background in social work and public affairs, and so I currently have a company called Social Motion that does coaching, consulting, and training. And what I do is I really kind of work, well, I launched my business in 2006, and I really work with individuals and communities to help us to better innovate and collaborate and create systemic change, which is, I think, what we're going to talk about today as well. And so I work primarily with government to really help government scale up and support effective ideas that are addressing a lot of the community challenges that we face today and addressing them in new ways that better engage the communities impacted by things like health disparities and economics, all the things that we're going to be talking about today, I'm guessing. So thank you for having us.
All right. Thank you.
I also should mention I have a podcast too, Social Change Leaders Podcast. So it's good to be with a fellow podcaster today.
All right. Well, thank you. And what platforms is your podcast available on?
All of them, Spotify, iTunes, okay. the normal ones. Yep.
Okay. So what we're going to be talking about today, we're sitting here in, was it quarter two of 2020? There's a lot going on. There are literally riots in the streets right now. There's protests in the streets right now over the police brutality and excessive force and the recent police killings of at least two unarmed black people within the last 2 weeks. So what's come about probably a little bit before these riots and protests kicked off? So there were a lot of memes on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. There was kind of a bubbling up of this concept of white privilege and Karen, and even a male Karen who we'll talk about also. But there's been a lot of controversy over this word Karen. There's been white women who have said that the word Karen is equivalent to the word nigger, that it's a racial slur and things of that nature. And even amongst black people, there's been a controversy about should we use the word or not. So there's on one hand, people that say, well, by the definition of Karen that they operate under, they're looking at white women who call the authorities, whether it be the store manager, security, or the police, when she sees a black person just doing mundane, regular things. I think the first Karen was in Oakland or San Francisco when the black gentlemen were barbecuing in the park. She called the police because there were black people barbecuing in the park. And personally, that was the first time I had heard the term Karen. And I think that was maybe a year or two ago, probably closer to 2 years ago. But, you know, here we are 2 years later, still going on. Maybe a few days after George Floyd was murdered, there was a white gentleman in Minneapolis, who attempted to call the police on some black gentlemen in the gym because he didn't recognize them. They had a membership, they were allowed to be there, but he just didn't know them, so he was going to call the police. So that's why I say, you know, it's not just women, but the term Karen has become popular with regard to women calling the police for reasons you really shouldn't call the police on people of color. So with that being said, some people use it for that definition, and then there are other people that are just calling any white woman who they don't like a Karen. Personally, I don't agree with that, because, you know, I think the term fits. You know, it's almost like calling someone a bigot or a racist a Karen. But if you're just using it to call any white person that made you mad or upset, you're diluting it. You are using it in an offensive manner, an inappropriate manner. And that's the part where I personally don't agree with that, that term being used. But I will kick it back to you guys and kind of give your input on what the word means to you based on your familiarity with it, how recent or how long you've known about such terminology.
Like I shared, I mean, recently, it was until maybe a few months, honestly. And so again, that it just supports how protected I am as a white woman. Like it, you know, I also, just to say, Tracy and I both live in St. Paul, Minnesota. So we didn't say that earlier. Maybe Tracy did, I did not. So that's a layer going on, obviously, all around us, personally here in our neighborhoods, just blocks away. But you know, what I want to respond to right away is I think, you know, as a lot of liberal women hear that word Karen, it's easy to be feel righteous. It's easy to say, well, I wouldn't do that. You know, again, it's that I, they, which I think collectively liberal white women do all the time. I'm the good white woman. I'm doing these things. I'm focusing on this. I'm protesting here. I'm calling this person. I'm writing this letter. I'm not the Karen. But really, we need to own that. We're all Karen on some continuum. And I think that collectively, white women need to just own our history. And I think we get caught up in bad, good, right, wrong. It's very much part of a cultural thing for us. They, we, you know, we're very definitive. And I think what I want to say is that we all collectively as white women need to own our history. We have a violent, violent history. And we need to do a lot of inward work around how we have been socially conditioned. I was socially conditioned at a very young age to be afraid of black and brown people because of the media when I was growing up. I mean, the whole, you know, war on drugs and the constant visual of violence in different neighborhoods. It was never something that was questioned. It was just something we all accepted as truth. It wasn't something that, as a girl, my parents sat me down and talked about, well, I mean, this is systemic and this is what's going on. And clearly there are many pockets of, you know, black culture that are thriving and doing well. It was never that. It was just, this is the reality. We just bought into it. So from a very young age, I was conditioned to never, you know, white girls don't go here, white girls go here, white girls don't live here, white girls live here. And all of that to me supports this behavior, right? In some way, shape, or form. And so for me, I just think, sure, I mean, there is an extreme of everything, but for me, it's more important to own how I support that, how I have also been conditioned to have that framework from a young age and to do my internal work and to focus on my own thing versus worrying. I mean, I'm concerned, I should care, I should say something, I should speak up, obviously. But at the same time, it's important to me not to be getting my righteous, you know, get my righteous space. And well, that's those are the women that vote for this person. I vote for this person. That's not acceptable anymore.
So
white women, we have to own this collectively.
So one thing you spoke about is being conditioned.
Yeah.
So I guess I have two questions about that, or one question and one statement.
Sure, please.
What part of that conditioning do you feel came directly from your parents? Were they more for it or against racism based on how they educated you? Did they actually teach you things, or did they just kind of imply by their actions and you observed how they moved to go left or right?
Sure. I think this is a fantastic question. So I was raised, actually, Glenn, I was raised in a small town, northern part of the state. I was a minister's daughter. My dad's a Lutheran pastor. So I was very much brought up and, you know, God is love, God is grace, God is, you know, God loves everyone, right? So there's that dichotomy where God loves everyone, but we're afraid of these people, you know, and there was never that question of, well, you know, if God loves everyone, why aren't we doing more to be understanding and loving? So it was more passive. It was just like the news would be on, we'd see these visuals, we collectively as a family would feel sad and helpless, and then we'd just do nothing or say nothing. There was no conversation. It was like this untouchable topic, very taboo. I mean, it was like, you know, the word shame comes up all the time in white culture, right? We're so immobilized by our shame. So instead of addressing the racism in our country, what I did as a child or what my family did is we helped poor people overseas. We helped refugees. You know, we did all these other things for people of color that weren't in our country. That made us feel better. Made us feel like we were being good Christians, good people. See, does that make sense?
Yeah. So I know, Tracy, we spoke earlier this week about the video. I don't know if either of you got a chance to watch the video of the young girl, and I don't know her age. I don't know much about the backstory because it's just a video I've seen on Instagram and Facebook. This girl looks like she's an early teen, maybe 12, 13, 14, and she is recording a conversation she's having with her parents, who her parents are telling her to stop watching the news and stop watching things on the internet about the riots and about Floyd George and about the police brutality issue. And she is literally arguing back and forth with her parents about how they're wrong, how they're sticking their heads in the sand, and how she's trying to be informed beyond what they see on the news on television. So with something like that, you know, what you just said, Sarah, and also Tracy, I want to get your feedback on that. How is it in that situation where you're a child or you're a young person and your parents either teach you one way or they leave out a lot of information because either they don't know or they don't want to kind of be pro-black? But how is it in your view that people that are younger, teenagers, college students, even preteens, I think they know better than what they're being taught in a lot of these households, but it's still, if you have to live in this house for 18 years, you can't really fight for 18 years. At some point, either you have to go undercover and just have your beliefs, or you give in and take their beliefs, or you're just confused. So how do you all feel about things of that nature?
Yeah, well, first, hats off to that amazing young woman for having the courage to speak to her parents and call them out on that. So I just want to acknowledge that young woman. And I, similar to Sarah, was raised in a very progressive household, I would say. And we watched Mississippi Burning and we watched the movies and we educated ourselves. And honestly, for me, my background is in social work. So I've studied this, I've learned about this. But honestly, I didn't really come to a real depthful understanding of my own participation in white supremacist structures and systems until much later in life. Probably, if I'm being honest, probably within the last 6-7 years that I really started to understand this. And so as I was watching that video, I was pretty amazed that this young woman was so able to have a depthful understanding. And she referenced a friend there was something that came out in the conversation about a friend that she referenced and how this friend's parents talked to him. So I got the impression that this person was potentially black or brown or indigenous friend that she had. And I just couldn't help thinking that that has to be a big part of this, that she's had a personal experience and she's been part of an education system that hopefully has taught her different history lessons than what probably Sarah and I were raised with. And it made me feel pretty optimistic about the future and the next generation, their ability to lead us to a better place around racism, white body supremacy, et cetera. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. That video and a few others definitely have given me a hope that the next generation or the next couple of generations are going to try to do the right thing.
Yeah. Yep.
So
I can share.
Oh, go ahead.
So I want to share what happened to me this morning, because I think it gives some context to what Sarah was saying about that maybe there's different levels of care in this. That's how I see it too. And I'm just going to be real humble and be real honest about something that came up for me this morning, because I think it illustrates the point that all of us white people have this in us. And we have to just own it, and we have to just own it and deal with it. And so I woke up this morning and I was feeling really nervous about doing this podcast. And I don't typically get nervous about stuff like this. My stomach was on a few knots. But you know, overall, people that know me, I'm pretty confident. I'm pretty comfortable in my own skin. You know, and I grew up in a family that was taught to own our mistakes. So I don't have that perfectionistic thing in me. I just kind of roll into things and I know I'm going to screw up and I do my best to learn from it. And, you know, I'm a lifelong learner. I work in the area of health disparities. So I was thinking this morning, like, why am I nervous? You know, I work in health disparities. So I, quote, know some of the words. I know the lingo. You know, and I have been on my own journey for a number of years. So I feel like I know what I think. I'm familiar with the issues. You know, my background is in public policy. And the topic today is Karens and racism. And so I'm comfortable with the public policies and I'm comfortable with the topic. And, you know, Glenn, you've been gracious and kind. I felt comfortable about that. But I just was, and I've been on podcasts before. I have a podcast, and I was just could not figure out why I was feeling nervous. And I felt a little sick to my stomach, to be honest. And it just, there's no reason for me to feel nervous. There was no logical reason. And it was just a reminder and an illustration to me yet again, how, you know, this is what white supremacy does to us. This is what white supremacy is about. And because we as white people have been raised in this fishbowl, and we've been so protected, and any type of discussion around race, racism, white supremacy, Karens, it makes us so uncomfortable. And you know, we live in this world where we don't have to talk about it. I'm very comfortable talking about this topic to white people, but I was feeling really nervous about it. And, you know, it just was this feeling of, you know, white guilt and knowing that I'm a part of the problem, and it's never fun to own that. And just knowing I felt pressure because I was feeling pressure that I should be saying something that would be helpful or possibly healing to your audience, but knowing that's not possible, that's not going to happen. And I just, and you know, I feel like I also, as a white person, you know, I've been doing so much listening, and I really believe we need to be doing so much listening. And, I did not want to be the white person to put myself out there and talk. There are much more important voices that we should be talking to. And, you know, we just have this white fragility. So, but then I think that really makes the point is that this is what happens because we as white, especially as white women, and I'm only speaking for myself, but we as white women, we're so protected and we get uncomfortable. And even me, who by on paper, I should be very comfortable. I should have been very comfortable doing this podcast this morning. But when we're uncomfortable, when white people get uncomfortable, that is when bad things happen to people. And so we as white women, we've got to step into this discomfort and we have to get more comfortable being humble. Number one, we have to be humble with the fact that we're going to say the wrong things. We're going to do the wrong things. We're going to screw up. So we have to do our own work. We have to read the books. We have to educate ourselves and we have to embody some new practices. And we just have to get comfortable. We have to get comfortable talking about this with people that are different from ourselves. And so I just want to share that. And I'm sharing that humbly as just to kind of illustrate the point that you know, I'm a Karen. I kind of think all white women, we all have, maybe I'll say it this way. I think we all have Karen-ness in us. And I think it's incumbent on all of us to do our work so that we, when we do get nervous having these conversations that are uncomfortable for all of us, when we get nervous, bad things happen. So we all have to do our work because that is why we have the George Floyd incident. And that's why we have white women calling the cops because a person asked her to put her dog on a leash. And this is why these things happen, because we white people are uncomfortable having the discussion and owning our part of it. And I just, so I just share that as a, just kind of saying for myself this morning, it was a big splash of cold water. Like, yep, even something that I should be pretty comfortable with, talking about race, owning it is never, ever comfortable for white people, I don't think. I mean, yeah, I don't know. Something, is that resonating, Sarah? Is that ring true for you?
Different reasons why, but absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, you said a few things that I'm probably not going to remember to touch on all of them, but the word comfort was repetitive in what you said. And at the root of all this comfort is, it seems to me, that's the root of all these issues, because for a number of reasons, white people might be uncomfortable with black people. Going about our daily routine, bird watching, ask you to put your dog on a leash, that became uncomfortable for some reason. When you know you're breaking the rule, you know you're breaking a rule.
Right.
But you're uncomfortable when a Black person calls you out on breaking a rule that you know you're breaking.
Right.
And then you're uncomfortable enough that you call the police and make up a lie.
Yep.
Because I don't, now it's, are you uncomfortable with the fact that you've already crossed the line? So you just have to go all the way. Well, you know, I've come this far, so I just got to try to get this guy locked up now, because, you know, that's, that will prove I'm right. If he goes to jail,
sure. Right.
Then that proves that I was correct in
right.
my assumptions about him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, getting comfortable with yourself is one thing. Then you have to get comfortable with people of color. And then you have to get comfortable with the idea that people of color are rising up.
Absolutely.
You know, just, you know, we see on television every day the last week or two, different cities have a Black mayor, a white police chief, a white police lieutenant reporting to a Black police chief. And you can see tension in these interviews. I've seen lower level officials question and debate with their higher level Black officials on television over the last week. Mm-hmm. Which that doesn't normally, you don't normally see a police chief questioning the mayor, or you know, a mayor questioning, or excuse me, a lieutenant questioning the police chief. This is just unheard of, but for some reason they're comfortable doing that, but they're not comfortable taking commands from that person. Mm-hmm. So it, I think it goes pretty deep.
Absolutely.
It does. Yep. And I think there's you said something about the There's a concept by Robin DiAngelo called white fragility. And for those that maybe aren't familiar with that, it's this notion that, you know, we just, white people just cannot handle any level of racial stress. And what happens is we become defensive, and we live in a culture that really protects us. And we as white people often get to dictate the rules and the terms of how we discuss these issues. And so I agree. I've noticed some of those same conversations, and just have been very dialed into the fact that there's a lot of white fragility rearing its head. There's a lot of discomfort, and I don't know, just kind of get the sense that it's an uncomfortable topic for white people to be called out on something that we should be called out on.
So. All right. So kind of bringing it back to current events, you know, as we keep referencing the uprisings in the streets, you know, we have DC literally was on fire a couple of days ago. LA has had some riots. Minneapolis has had riots. And one thing that's been kind of a common thread is that there's tension between the protesters. The protesting is about Black Lives Matter. It's about police brutality. And of course, all people, as we see now, are being victimized by the police. But this was started because of Black people being victimized by the police. We're seeing a lot of these peaceful protests turn violent for a number of reasons. One being that when the police show up, they're heavy-handed, and they cause people to escalate to a level of violence when they were formerly peaceful. On another hand, we have different groups, Antifa, white supremacists, and just white people that think they're trying to help. And it's kind of, it's hard to tell who's who. When you have a protest of 1,000 Black people and 200 white people, you don't know which of these white people are white supremacists, Antifa, right. or just white people that want to help.
Right.
So the confusion that's being stirred up, there's allegations that some of these white people are the ones that are starting to break the windows and they're starting the looting. And then the Black people follow in, and then, oh, look at all the Black people looting happens.
Right. Absolutely.
And that's just changed
it, right? Changes 180 yeah. degrees. And,
yeah, and
they completely ignore how the riot started. It just right. is who's getting hit over the head with a nightstick on right. CNN is all that matters.
Right.
So I said that to say, to circle back around to those white people that want to help. Mm-hmm. Let's not talk about the white supremacists. We know what they're doing. Let's not talk about Antifa. We kind of know what they're going to do. But the white people that want to help, there's been a lot of debate over should people of color win this fight on our own, or should we let the white people talk to other white people and get their message across by talking to a familiar face? So I guess it's kind of, it's a, I think it's more of a prideful thing to say, hey, we're going to do it on our own. But realistically, I think that we need a certain amount of involvement from white people who are, as they call them, allies, who can spread the message. Because I'm no psychologist, but based on my observations, people accept information from people that look like them.
Yes.
A lot better than some stranger that they're unfamiliar with already. You can look at the NFL. 4 years ago, Kaepernick took a knee. He got fired. There's mm-hmm. been protest on both sides, pro Kaepernick and anti Kaepernick. 4 years later, yesterday, the top 10 NFL players put out a video that says they support taking a knee. They support Black Lives Matter. And they question, why hasn't the NFL said anything in support of these matters? In a couple of hours, the NFL commissioner releases a statement that says, you know what? We were wrong about how we handled Kaepernick 4 years ago. We should have thought things through differently. We should have listened to the players. It doesn't take 4 years to figure that out.
Right.
It took the spotlight from a group of people to call him out. And then that plus these riots and protests that are going on.
Popular.
Right.
Fluent, successful people.
Exactly.
It wasn't Tracy and I making the video of that.
Right. So yeah. I guess where I'm going with that is that also parallels what's happened in society. We have literally been complaining about police brutality as far as I'm 40 years old, but I know since the 1960s, if you watch Sanford and Son, if you watch Good Times, if you watch, you know, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air in the 80s and 90s, if you watch, I could list a dozen shows where they discuss police brutality going back in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And I know white people love these shows. White people watch The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Oh, absolutely. You know. The Jeffersons?
Right, the Jeffersons.
Yes, yes.
But it took from, you know, segregation, Jim Crow ended in the 60s. So we're looking at 40, 50 years that we've been complaining about the same issue. Mm-hmm. We've been shining a huge spotlight on it since the 80s because, you know, look at NWA, Ice-T. These were huge rappers. Everybody listens to NWA. They made a whole album about police brutality. Mm-hmm. Ice-T started a whole band and they made songs about police brutality. It was, you know, the president was talking about Ice-T's song where he referenced killing police officers. So even from that point in the 90s, we're still 30 years north of that. Mm-hmm. And we're just now starting to have real conversation and like the light bulb is just going on 60 years later. That, hey, you know what? Maybe the police are hitting them upside the head more than they're hitting us upside the head. Mm-hmm. Why does it take so long? And so many mega superstars, even I think Bruce Springsteen and several popular, the E Street Band, they've all made songs about police brutality also, but nothing until we literally start burning cities down.
And that's if you look at our history, you know, that's how that has gone along with it. You know, the civil rights movement. I don't know if there wouldn't have been some of that. I'm not sure that we would have accomplished some of the things in the 60s. It took some of that to really get people's attention. Unfortunately.
And I just want to interject. You know, I've been talking with different friends about having skin in the game, and I think you mentioned this in your outline, Glenn. Like, why? You know, why does it have to take such extreme measures? Why? I think when you live such a segregated life, I mean, I lived such a segregated life. It wasn't until my mid-20s that I had to move to the East Coast to live in cities with people of color. I mean, I lived such a segregated life. It was always so outside of my world, right? And I'm not justifying that at all. I think, you know, ultimately this is about decency, humanity, justice. But I do think when people live such segregated lives, all these rural communities, I mean, the fact that rural communities are protesting, to me, that's very encouraging. Mm-hmm. Because it shows they have some skin in the game, right? And that's just a human theme. Like if someone I love and care about is being harmed, I am absolutely going to do. But if this is just this outside, like on my TV, one dimensional, my whole life, it's just been on a movie or my television screen. I have friends that, you know, didn't even see a person of color until they went to college. They didn't even see a person of color, let alone have them as a friend or a classmate. So, I mean, when you're that segregated, I just think you're so detached. I'm not justifying that. I think that's obviously part of white supremacy. It's this whole thing that we've talked about being protected, being segregated. But, you know, the fact that I'm encouraged because it shows that the world has skin in the game, right? The world is responding to this in a very active way. I see that as a good thing. Now, let me couple it by saying also white culture, we tend to want to, you know, our whole white savior energy is something we have to be checking all the time. You know, what is motivating us to take these actions? Is it because it's of justice? It's the human decent thing to do? Or is it like the savior mentality, right? So we always, as white culture, have to be checking that always, all the time, every day, all the time. But at the same time, in addition to doing just action, I really speak for myself. Like, my internal work is not even more important for me, because I need to understand history. I need to understand my culture. I went to a workshop at my church 4 years ago about white culture. And I was so humbled by it, because I'm like, isn't this just Western culture, these characteristics? No. It's white dominant culture. Yeah, Glenn's good. Yeah, I saw that. And, you know, I've been so conditioned to think that you know, how time is handled, how, you know, again, that perfectionism, that urgency, all these different qualities of our Western culture. No, it's white dominant culture. It's my culture. And, you know, again, humbling, right? So I think there's just so much white culture needs to learn and listen. We need to be listening. We need to be listening so attentively and always checking ourselves, always checking our action. Why am I doing this? Why am I saying this? Am I centering myself? Or am I lifting up? Am I pointing the light on, you know, a person of color who has the moral authority, right? I mean, it's a constant thing to be checking my actions all the time.
Yeah. And I want to add this too, getting back to your question about why does it, you know, why now? I was actually in a part of a discussion last night that we talked about this, and it was really interesting because I think, and so it was in Mankato, Minnesota, and it was an online thing, but people were talking about, do we think that it would be this much of an issue if people weren't at home because of COVID, if people weren't watching the news and watching TV 24/7, and not, you know, a lot of people are home working from home, if Trump, you know, if the presidential leadership that's happening has people filled with a lot of angst. We really wondered if this would be getting the attention it would be. And, you know, I don't know.
I think one key factor is that there are, what, 40 million unemployed people right now, on top of the regular standard level of unemployed people. Right. So people have nothing to do. You know, right. So what is it to go protest all day, 5 days a week? I'm not doing anything at home. So I think this time right now is kind of the, from my perspective, the best time it could have ever happened. And from Trump's perspective, the worst time it could have ever happened, because people have nothing else to do. And their own unemployment, so the bills are paid to a certain degree. So it's kind of like, well, you know, I can't get a job anyway, so might as well go out here and do something else productive.
And make a contribution. Yep, I agree with you. Yep.